The mind's self-deception and its antidotes, from Kishore Chandiramani. When we are in a negative frame of mind, we tend to exaggerate the negatives and deny the positives in our lives. The opposite happens when we are in a happy frame of mind or in a manic phase, that is, we tend to exaggerate the positives and deny the negatives. We also tend to distort certain realities of our lives because they, as we perceive them, are not acceptable to us. If we accepted those realities as they are, it may lead to intolerable emotional reaction that can threaten the integrity of our mental functions. We therefore unconsciously end up distorting the reality so that it's acceptable to us and doesn't cause any intolerable emotions. It's a way in which the mind protects itself from psychic trauma. Now let us examine why the reality as we see it may be unacceptable to us. It may be because of our definitions of what is normal. And if things don't fit in the normal or desirable mold, we feel the need to distort it in order to avoid the discomfort that comes with the thought that things are not normal. However, there is a positive side to this distortion as well, which we are going to talk about here now. I would like to talk about authenticity, that is, genuineness and truthfulness, as it's linked with what we are going to discuss here. The word authenticity means our external behavior and opinions are consistent with our inner self. It's about acting in accordance with our inner self. If we are saying that distortion of the reality is the main problem, then authenticity should be the antidote, as it encourages us to be with the reality and become real. Carl Gustav Jung, a renowned psychiatrist and a psychotherapist, had said that the conscious mind and the unconscious mind work in tandem, at times allowing expression of an unconscious urge, whereas at other times compensating for each other's excesses by creating something which is just the opposite. The conscious mind creates the opposite of what is there in the unconscious mind to strike a balance and be able to express one's desires and motivations in a socially desirable manner. If what is held in the unconscious mind is socially acceptable and desirable, then the conscious mind will facilitate its expression without any distortions. But if the conscious mind realizes that the contents of the unconscious mind may not meet with approval from others and can potentially create a difficult situation for oneself, then it works on the unconscious impulses by distorting the reality in such a way that the person becomes comfortable with the original thought or the emotion and it becomes socially acceptable and desirable. To give an example, if a child becomes angry towards their parent and feels that if they express this anger, it may not be acceptable to them or to others, the anger then gets converted into intense self-loathing and results in depression or suicidal thoughts. And instead of blaming or targeting the parent, they end up blaming themselves for having the anger, because in their mind the thought that the parent is bad is more unacceptable than the thought that they themselves are bad. To some extent, this distortion of reality happens in our dreams as well. And in psychotic states, a totally unacceptable idea finds its expression in dreams or in hallucinations in a symbolic or distorted fashion, so that the message is conveyed to those who can understand and tolerate, and not conveyed to those who haven't acquired the ability to understand and tolerate it as yet. According to psychoanalytic theories, depression and suicidal thoughts are an expression of anger turned inwards, and its clinical implications are that one should always try to explore the client's aggressive feelings towards oneself and others if they present with depression or suicidal thoughts. The next question we need to ask is whether this distortion of reality is desirable or undesirable. Is it adaptive or maladaptive? A simple answer to this question is that it's adaptive in the short term, as it protects the person's psychic functioning from further damage, as the raw emotions that can accompany the perception of one's reality can threaten one's mental functioning. The strong emotions are therefore blanked out of one's awareness, as the perception of their reality is distorted. However, they become maladaptive if one continues to use these defenses in the long term, as they come in the way of one's psychological growth. It's therefore important to have a reasonable understanding of all these defense mechanisms so that one can overcome these obstacles that are there in the way of one's personal development at the right time. I would now like to talk about the diverse ways in which our mind tries to distort the reality with a view to defending itself from psychological trauma. At the most basic level, the defenses that operate are denial and projection. And these involve disowning one's responsibility in creating these negative emotions or allowing them to happen. The denial can mean refusing to acknowledge the existence of something, that is, a thought or an emotion, and one's personal responsibility in its occurrence. If one refuses to acknowledge the existence of an experience, then there is no need to use any further defenses such as projection or displacement. But if one acknowledges the existence of an emotion or a thought and is not comfortable about taking responsibility for it, then the second line defense mechanisms of projection or displacement or any other defense come into play and help the client shift the emotion to something else. A common expression, "It was not me who did it, but you made me do it." This can happen normally as well. We make some mistakes but want to blame others for creating the conditions in which that mistake happened. The defense mechanism of denial is also seen in neurotic conditions such as anxiety, depression, phobia, obsessions, and it can also happen in psychotic conditions such as schizophrenia and mania. The difference is that of a degree initially, and in psychosis, one refuses to acknowledge even the things that are blatantly obvious, that is, one's identity, family members, work and life situations. We need to understand why the mind is trying to shut these feelings out of consciousness here. Perhaps the feeling is intolerable and unacceptable to the person. In a situation like this, making the person confront the truth is not going to be helpful, but one must make the person psychologically stronger so that they themselves are willing to accept the truth and there won't be any need for confrontation. At times, this projection takes the form of projective identification. An example of that would be, if you yourself are feeling angry but don't want to take responsibility for it and want to project it onto somebody else, but the other person doesn't appear aggressive to you at all, then you behave in such a manner that the other person becomes angry with you and then you can justify your aggression and can see it as a response to that person's aggressive behavior. One can thereby justify one's anger and it becomes more acceptable to oneself. This is commonly seen in marital situations where you want to explain a lot of your own behavior based on what has been done to you by your spouse. This understanding can help you realize that if the other person is blaming you for getting angry, it's not about you that they are getting angry, but because they are projecting their own anger onto you. And because you can't do it easily, they are provoking you to anger so that they can justify their own anger as a reaction to your anger. This understanding can help you hold back and not fall into this trap of behaving in a way the other person expects you to behave to justify their own emotions. The defense mechanism of reaction formation is a type of defense that can explain how the conscious mind and the unconscious mind work in opposite ways. If the unconscious mind has emotions and feelings that are destructive, undesirable, antisocial, and the conscious mind becomes aware of them, then it creates a facade of attitudes, feelings, and behavior that are just the opposite of what is in the unconscious mind and starts behaving in a socially desirable manner. This leads to repression of one's unconscious impulses and wishes to the extent that they don't even find expression in the real world, apart from the opposite behavior that is exhibited by the conscious mind. If there are elements of laziness in the unconscious mind, the conscious mind can adopt an attitude of hyper-punctuality and perfectionism that we commonly see in obsessive-compulsive individuals. If there are elements of attraction in immoral behavior, then the conscious mind can adopt a very rigid moral stance on issues to the point that immorality in others becomes intolerable and one starts a crusade against them. If there are elements of aggression or indifference to people in the unconscious mind, then the conscious mind adopts a persona of over-politeness and helpfulness to others. And if deep down one suffers from low self-esteem, then it can result in ideas of grandiosity and excessive self-importance in the conscious mind. There are important clinical implications to this understanding. That is, if one understood that the way the other person is behaving is just the opposite of what they are experiencing deep down inside themselves, then one would choose to react differently to their behavior. It may be that in certain situations, one's aggression towards others will turn into compassion if their behavior can be understood in the light of what is there in the unconscious mind. In a similar fashion, if one applies this to one's own self, one can realize that creating the opposite of what is there in the unconscious mind is not helpful in the long run, as at some stage, one has to acknowledge what is there in the unconscious mind in order to begin the process of self-healing and psychological growth. Living a lie doesn't help in the long run. Another important defense I want to talk about here is called somatization. It means that if one is not able to work through their psychological conflicts at the psychological level, their unconscious mind converts the conflict without their own knowledge into a somatic symptom or a physical symptom. Sigmund Freud called this defense conversion reaction, which means that primarily the problem was psychological, but it got converted into somatic or physical symptom because of the individual's inability to manage the problem at a psychological level. However, If one studies other schools of psychology and philosophy, one will realize that psyche and soma, that is mind and body, have been understood as the two sides of the same coin. Almost all problems manifest or have the potential of manifesting in the form of both psychological as well as physical symptoms. Some people who are more psychologically sophisticated express their distress in the form of psychological symptoms or conflicts, whereas those who are somatically sophisticated try to describe their symptoms more in terms of bodily sensations. Sigmund Freud himself said, "There cannot be a psychology without a biology," which means every thought and emotion has a molecule in our body. Unfortunately, psychology, or for that matter, psychiatry, has not developed to the extent where the various somatic symptoms can be understood or explained in terms of psychological disorders. Hence, professionals tend to describe these physical symptoms as vague somatic symptoms or medically unexplained physical symptoms. Whereas many Eastern contemplative methods have understood the functioning of the mind in terms of the whole body functioning and have produced the maps of the mind that can explain the origin, the existence, and dissipation of these somatic symptoms in a very scientific manner. The practical application of this understanding is that we can understand a lot of unpleasant bodily symptoms or sensations in our body that we experience daily in terms of our unconscious emotions that need to be worked on psychologically. Another defense that is commonly used is called repression, which means that the thought or the emotion that is unacceptable to the conscious mind gets pushed into the unconscious mind without the person being aware of it. This is the most basic defense and operates alongside a lot of other defense mechanisms. This is commonly seen in panic attacks where the person feels a sense of dread and catastrophe without knowing the exact cause. Repression is generally used to ward off the emotions of anxiety, anger, and sexual feelings. There are many more defenses that can help us understand others' behavior, that is, teenagers using minimization and counterphobic behavior to indulge in risky behavior. The counterphobic means going ahead and doing the feared activity, which may involve risk-taking with a view to overcoming the fear. Alcohol-dependent individuals normally use denial and rationalization. And identification with a lost relative is often seen in bereavement reactions. Similarly, identification and negative identification with a parent figure can explain a lot of behaviors that may not be consistent with one's own inner self. Identification would mean imbibing or acting in a way that your parents behaved, and this is based on a defense called introjection. It protects you from a sense of loss because a part of your parent has been imbibed in yourself. However, for certain adolescents, it's just the opposite. If they had a feeling of dislike or a feeling that their parents were not able to achieve in their lives that they had set out to achieve or were inadequate in some ways, then one has the temptation to do just the opposite in order to reach life goals different from the ones their parents had achieved. This negative identification can make them do things just the opposite of what their parents did. There's nothing wrong with following these lines of action, but it may be counterproductive if these behaviors, that is both identification and the negative identification, are not consistent with one's true inner identity. Another related defense mechanism is identification with the aggressor. which is a mechanism of coping with fear and trauma by way of behaving like the abuser. The examples could be: a sexually abused person becomes a sexual abuser. A bullied person becomes a bully himself. A victim becomes the aggressor. And a cheated person becomes the cheat. I must say that this doesn't happen with every individual. It's only those who are not able to work through their emotions of being at the receiving end that they go on to become the perpetrators and find this as a way of dealing with their emotions, as they haven't found a better way of dealing with these emotions. In therapy, perhaps they can learn how to handle their emotions in a more mature and adaptive way. So far, we have discussed only about half a dozen defense mechanisms, but according to an estimate, there are about 100 different defense mechanisms that our mind uses to shield itself from stress. I would now like to discuss the concept of ego strength, as it might help us understand the mind's ability to cope with stress and how to enhance it. The mind's ability to handle stress can be described as ego strength, and the force of the unconscious emotion can be described as the unconscious impulses. Just as the conscious mind is constantly confronted by the demands from the outside world, it's also confronted by the demands imposed upon it from these unconscious impulses. If the force of the unconscious impulses is greater than one's ego strength, then one feels destabilized, unable to concentrate, anxious, depressed, restless, agitated, and unable to enjoy life, irrespective of having a strong ego strength. On the other hand, if the ego strength of the conscious mind is stronger than the unconscious impulses, one feels in control, calm and collected, focused, able to enjoy things, even if the force of the unconscious impulses is strong. For managing one's stress, it's therefore not sufficient to just manage the stresses imposed upon the person from the outside world, but one must constantly work at increasing the ego strength of the conscious mind and reducing the force of the negative unconscious impulses. All the defense mechanisms that we have talked about are helpful in the sense that they protect the ego or the conscious mind from these harmful unconscious impulses by deflecting them. But if used long term, they don't allow the conscious mind to work on these unconscious impulses and neutralize them. Stress management therefore involves three things. Number one, reducing the demands placed upon the conscious mind from the outside world by way of lifestyle changes. Number two, reducing the demands placed upon the conscious mind from inside. Number three, ability of the conscious mind to manage these demands. In view of this, the core issues in therapy should be how to increase the ego strength or the ability of the conscious mind to manage the demands from the outside world and also from the inside. The following techniques can be used. Number one, practicing equanimity with the help of breath awareness and using the principle of impermanence, which has been described in this program elsewhere. Second, adopting a witnessing attitude without being judgmental about things related to one's own mind and the outside world. Number three, not identifying with the contents of the mind that are constantly changing, but trying to understand oneself in terms of the characteristics or traits that have been long-standing and are likely to persist long-term. Fourth, operating from a secure, silent base in the mind that is not made up of thoughts and feelings, as thoughts and feelings are constantly shifting and moving and will make it difficult for us to organize and manage things. It's therefore important that we stay connected with the inner consciousness that is silent and neutral. In short, not identifying with the thinking, judging, feeling and reacting part of the mind, but with the inner consciousness that remains a silent witness and simply reflects like a mirror. Number 5. Always be on the side of the truth, as it will steer us clear of using any defense mechanisms. Even if it means increasing our stress in the short term, as it will make us more authentic and more immune to stress in our everyday life. To conclude, I would like to say that there are two things that can help us with our psychological growth. Number 1, our ability to see the reality as it is. And number 2, being more accepting of it. And these two are interdependent. If we have an attitude of acceptance, then we'll be able to see more of the reality, as there'll be no attempts to distort it. And secondly, if we choose to follow the path of truth or stay on the side of the reality, then in trying to do so, we will gather strength, as it will require confronting our unpleasant emotions and working on them. Thank you. This recording was brought to you from Nature Consultancy, based at the Emotions Clinic Education and Training Center in Stoke-on-Trent, England.